Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. If you'd like to be part of the program tonight, you can do so by calling 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515. If you'd like to listen by cell phone, if you should happen to leave the security of the locale of your laptop, you can do so by calling in with your cell phone at 712-432-0075. Then put the access code 318-116-POUND. A few days ago, Sunspot Group 1147 was busily launching coronal mass ejections from the far side of the sun. Yesterday, it turned toward Earth and immediately quieted down. Is this the calm before the storm? Good question. Solar scientists are baffled. The solar wind is a blustery 483 kilometers per second and delivering awesome auroras in the northern sky. On January 11th, just a few days ago, about 8:45 p.m. Central Standard Time, many people in southeastern USA saw something streak across the sky and explode. The blast produced infrasound waves detected as far away as Canada. Data from a University of Western Ontario monitoring station reveals the nature of the event. Quote, "It was a meter-size meteor with more than a metric ton of mass exploding like 40 to 80 tons of TNT, says Bill Cook of NASA's Meteoroid Environment Office. He goes on, "This was one big rock, and the odds are good that there are fragments on the ground." An analysis of sightings by meteorite hunter Rob Mattson suggests the fall zone is in central Mississippi, possibly around Jackson. Gee, that's only about 45 minutes from where I am right now. People in the area should be alert for odd-looking rocks, places other than Walmart. After 6 weeks of darkness, unbroken by so much as a single ray of golden sunlight, global warming threw a monkey wrench into the tradition. In Ilulissat, Greenland, has axial precession taken a sudden lurch eastward? Was the Earth's crust swollen by the heat of global warming, raising the Greenlanders above the horizon? Did the Earth's magnetic field wander afield and move the planet's axis centerward? Did the peripatetic wanderings of the Earth's continents reach a tipping point and suddenly leave too much mass on one side of the planet, causing irregularity in its rotation? No. None of those things happened. However, in a different way, global warming does appear to be the culprit. But it didn't expand the Earth's crust. It's the oceans that expand in the presence of heat, not the crust. What it did do was to raise Greenland's mean temperature by 3 degrees Celsius. The upshot has been a melting of its glaciers, severe enough that sunlight, generally blocked by the western half of Greenland until January 13th, can now reach those previously darkened climes 2 days earlier. And that is why the sun seemed to rise 2 days earlier in 2011 than it did in 2010. So for those of you who think that global warming has not affected the rise of the sun, you're wrong. It did. Just by way of news, I want to let you know that Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, is available everywhere. And I recommend, highly recommend, that you pick it up at your local bookstore. How do you do that? Well, that is a great question. One of the ways that we self-published authors get our book out there and get it publicized is by those of you that have read it or want to read it, or those of you that have heard about it and want to see it, to go into your local bookstore and have the book shortlisted. Just go up to the customer service counter and say, hey, do you have Brooks Agnew's book, Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel? They'll say, no, we don't carry that book. Well, gee, I'd kind of like to buy it. So either I could order it through you, or you could shortlist it, and me and my friends could come in and buy it. Now, that doesn't mean that they're going to put it on the shelf, but they have to make a note that you requested it to be shortlisted. Well, guess who gathers that information? The book distributors do. And when the book distributors receive the requests for a book to be shortlisted at a local bookstore, they have to report it to the distributors and also to the New York Times. The New York Times takes that information about how the book is shortlisted, and they decide what is a New York Times bestseller or not. It isn't how many tens of thousands of books you've sold on Amazon. Believe me, there are a lot of New York Times bestsellers that you can't even buy on Amazon. Amazon sells a lot more books than the New York Times. But it is kind of neat to be on the New York Times bestseller list. It's a good marketing ploy, and I would like to partake of it. So if you, all around the country, all around the world, would go into your local bookstore and say, hey, would you shortlist Remembering the Future? It would help me out, and I would appreciate it. If you want to get it quickly, you can do that by ordering it at rememberingthefuturebook.com. Not only will you get the book autographed, but you'll get the audio download. Now, I have had a few people write me of late and say, hey, I bought the book. Here's my receipt. Where's my audiobook? Evidently, PayPal has developed a flaw. PayPal no longer will forward you by way of redirect to the download site. I was unaware of this. So I am working with PayPal right now to fix that bug. It's very time-consuming. We've been working on it for about 2 weeks now. Many, many phone calls, many, many hours on the phone with them. They can't figure it out. I can't figure it out. So if you ordered the book and did not get your audio download, please write me, and I will be happy to send you the link through your email. I answer every single email, especially if you ask me questions about the book, and we will make it right. So if you didn't get your audio book, please write me. As you're preparing for this winter, and some of us have already had quite a winter, we're not even halfway through January, we're not even to the big snow months yet, and yet flying from coast to coast in America is a little like flying across Antarctica. It's really unbelievable how much snow has fallen and how treacherous the roads can get. We here at X Squared Radio always want you to be prepared. And so we have searched far and wide and found a great supplier of emergency preparedness items for sale. Great prices, sometimes free shipping, for sure discounts if you order from here. And that supplier is 1-800-PREPARE.com. Don't go to Walmart. Don't go to Dick's Sporting Goods. You're going to pay too much. You're going to get old stuff. You're not going to get stuff packaged right. And it's not going to last. What you need to do is get a hold of my buddies at 1-800-PREPARE.com. Paul Faust and his friends, former firefighters from 9/11 in New York, have put together this website, and they have packaged the best stuff at the best prices. And not only do they have food that will last for 25 years. Now, talk about set it and forget it. This is the stuff. You can put it in a book bag that they'll provide you. Put it in your front door closet or in the trunk of your car. And next time, well, hopefully there won't be a next time, but should there be a next time for you or for anyone close to you, all you have to do is grab that bag and you're ready to go. Now, not only do they have the supplies, they also have training manuals, knowledge books about how to survive a tornado, a flood, a fire, where to contact emergency supply professionals, how to purify water, how to dress a wound, all kinds of things that you might not be aware of, and you don't have the time to go take a class about it. You can get it at 1-800-PREPARE.com. As you're checking out, make sure to put in my name, Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S, and you'll get an additional 10% off. No problems there. Hey, there was an astonishingly low number of earthquakes in the last 24 hours. Very strange. We watch it several times a week. We report it to you every Sunday so that you can kind of get a feel for how the earth is reeling to and fro, right? Normally we see around 24. Sometimes we get up around 36 or 37. Sometimes we have two or three earthquakes over 6.0, sometimes over 7.0. Those you hear about on the news. However, in the last 24 hours, only 16 earthquakes, and only three were over 5.0, and none were over 6.0. Now, that's a quiet earth. That is a quiet earth. Could be a good thing. Hopefully, it's a trend. Hopefully, the earth is settling down. Well, let's get to it. First hour of X Squared Radio coming up. 40 seconds. Don't go away. We'll be right back. Well, we thought things were heating up as we got toward the end of last year, October. We had unbelievable public UFO appearances over New York City all day long on national news. We covered it extensively in October. We dropped back and covered it again in November with the Nick Pope, who the former Minister of Defense for Great Britain, and also Dan Willis. And what we were trying to understand was, if we're having these daytime multiple hang-around UFO sightings over some of the largest cities in our nation, why is nobody going up and checking it out? Why no news helicopters? Why no military flyovers? What's going on? Why aren't we getting real-time data from these UFO sightings? It was really something amazing to watch. And no one really had the answer. But one thing we concluded for sure is that UFOs, if they are off-world, are as public as they want to be. Yes, that is to say, if they wanted to land, I was going to say on the White House land, on the White House lawn, but I mean, why do that? There's no intelligent life there. If they wanted to land somewhere where, you know, we could walk up and touch them, sort of a meet and greet, you know, a big barbecue fest or a fly-in at Oshkosh or something like that, they could do it. They could do it with impunity anytime they want. We decided that they're as public as they want to be. And we kind of felt relaxed about that. And we also commented on the idea that it seems science fiction about UFOs and aliens has really taken a strange twist lately. It's no longer the Close Encounters of the Third Kind, you know, old Spielberg kind of movie where, you know, they're coming to exchange explorers and go flying off into the netherworld. It's not like Cocoon where they're coming to Earth in a friendly way and taking Earthlings with them to live virtually forever. No, now it's more the eat your brain stuff and come and I don't know what's going on. It's like, I don't know. It's like Tales of the Crypt meets sci-fi. It has taken a very strange twist. And we have also contemplated the idea that science fiction writers, publicists, investors, those films that get the money, are the ones that are telling this very strange kind of dark kind of, hey, we need to gear up and arm ourselves and get ourselves ready to fight, not terrorists. Oh, no, we need to gear up to fight aliens, off-worlders with advanced technology and ships that can blink in and out of existence. We need special weapons. We need a dark budget that we can handle, and we want you to approve it. And it's a little disconcerting that science fiction seems to be going that way. Now, normally we would say, oh, you know, that's just Hollywood. But it isn't. I will tell you from maybe not first-hand experience, but certainly second-hand experience, Hollywood is a business, all right? We would like to think that it's art. Right now, as we speak, I'm competing with the Golden Globe Awards on public TV. The Golden Globe Awards, they're nominating one another for different kinds of acting and publishing and directing awards. And the public is watching it because, you know, we want to see these people off the big screen. We want to see them on the little screen. You want to go to Pasadena, you can catch them on the street there on Colorado Boulevard going down the red carpet to the Golden Globe Awards. Well, those awards are for movies from an artistic point of view. The interesting thing is that the great art, the really good writing, the really great screenplays, the ideas that would awaken a world, that would excite a populace, never get funded. Of the movies that you see, and believe me, some of them are absolute trash. I have a movie rating system myself. I'll share it with you. It is this. It's a very simple system. The highest rating that you can get is called big screen. Yes, that's a work of art that needs to be on the big screen. That's a big screen movie. The second is video, DVD. Yeah, I would rent the DVD and watch that movie. That's the second rating. The third one is the 2-for-1 video. Yeah, you rent one movie tonight, you get one free. It would be the free one. Okay, that's still not rock bottom. Rock bottom is public TV. Yeah, I'll go ahead and weather through the commercials because I need a break to go stick my finger down my throat as bad as this stuff is. Those are the four movie ratings. And there's been a lot of public TV movies hitting the screen lately. Junk. Artistically junk, directing junk, screenplay junk, camera angle junk, low budget junk. And sometimes they even have name brand stars in it. One such junk movie that just came out is called The Season of the Witch with Nicolas Cage. Now, Nicolas Cage is a world-class movie star. Not really an actor, but he's a good movie star. He does a good job. He brings good energy to the screen. He does his art well. He does Nicolas Cage well. And he draws people to the box office. What in the world he was doing in Season of the Witch is beyond me. Except that maybe he needed the money. Now, that being said, let's look at movies from a funding point of view. If people with money want to get a certain message out there, they will look for certain screenplays and they will fund them. And they will not fund screenplays that they don't feel good about. Now, when you look up at the movies and you're looking at the credits, you know, when they start out, well, that is to say, except Avatar. I'll explain that in just a second. When you look at those movies, you will see, oh, this is put out by Punk Rock Pictures. And the executive producer was, you know, Wacko McGillicuddy and on and on. Then you will see the executive producer and then you'll get an idea who is really the investor behind the movie. Now, some of this stuff has big production house backing, like Pixar or Disney or MGM or Sony, but most of them don't. Most of these movies are small movie houses that are putting out these movies. Now, interestingly enough, these B-movies make money because they have a production cost of about $1 million, $2 million, $3 million, and they'll make about $12 million back at the box office as they run for 2 or 3 weeks. And then they get a little more money, a few pennies on the DVD rentals. Case in point was The Last Mimsy. Terrible name, awesome movie. Really decent story, really decent acting, halfway decent directing, halfway decent special effects, but it was a great feel-good movie that completely flopped in the theaters. However, when it went live in DVD, June 15th of 2008, it took off like a rocket. Another one was the movie about the last Highlander, you know, the Highlander, the first Highlander movie, totally flopped in the movies and took off like a superstar when it hit DVD. It was rented like crazy. And that rental stimulated the production of 2 or 3 more movies, which went all kinds of different places that the first one had no intention of going. It's like, oh, we have the popularity to do a sequel? Well, let's write one. Yeah, most of the really good sequels are already written in a series, like Twilight. The books are already written, like Harry Potter. You know, the books are already written. We just follow the books and we do screenplays from the books. Well, most of the time, this is in a business of investment. And I can tell you, if you go to Hollywood, you go to Santa Monica, you go to Anaheim, you go to Newport, you are going to see thousands upon thousands upon thousands of screenplays being hawked by everyone. There are screenwriters all over the world. Everybody you meet is a screenwriter. Can they write screenplays? No, they can't. There's a certain format to writing a screenplay. You put it in that format, it might get read. If you don't hook them in the first 3 paragraphs, it's trashed. Unless you have a certain message. You have a message that those investors want to get out, then you're going to get funded. And some of that funding comes from really strange origins. Case in point. Now, if you want to comment on this, you can call in. It's 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4515. I can give you one example, and then I'm going to give you a second example, and you're going to be sold right there. First example is Top Gun. All right, Top Gun. Tom Cruise, playing, of course, Tom Cruise. A couple other names. Van Kilmer did a really decent job in the movie. Very well directed, very good music, and all a ton of military footage. You don't get pictures of those jets flying, doing those kinds of maneuvers next to a helicopter. You've got to be in another jet following that jet. And the only way you get in the jet is with military permission, military backing. And that's how Top Gun was such a famous movie. Officer and a Gentleman. Yeah, another one. That's right. Now, thank you for that, by the way. The one I had in mind was one even more militaristic as far as the sponsorship and involvement. And guess who is side by side with them, morph by morph, all the way through the movie? That's right, General Motors. That's right, Transformers. Good guess. That's right. Transformers is the movie I'm talking about. General Motors and the U.S. military team up to make a war movie with morphing General Motors vehicles right in the midst of General Motors bankruptcy. And what car did they feature? That's right. They featured the new Chevrolet Camaro. That yellow Camaro with the black stripes, that was a loser. That was a high horsepower, low mileage car that was going to command one of the highest insurance premiums in the nation next to the Corvette. And yet here it is, hooking kids. Taking kids' toys, mixing them with General Motors and the military in a movie about bad aliens. So now you see what we're putting together. They're getting darker, and they're getting more hopeless. Like Cloverfield was a good one. Hopeless, hopeless movie. Total destruction all the way through, right up to the very last moment when everyone who was narrating the movie dies. Another one is Skyline, recently came out. Also, for all intents and purposes, a B-movie. B-acting, B-special effects, a B-story. This was like something that you would normally see on the small screen on sci-fi as a sci-fi movie with tons of commercials in between. Not a big screen movie. Not at all. So what's going on here? Well, I have a point. I have a point. I'm getting there. At the end of last year, as I was saying, we had an unbelievable plethora of UFO sightings. One after the other after the other. And they were from West Coast to East Coast, broad daylight, long periods of sightings, sighted by thousands of people, caught on national television. But nobody goes and investigates. Huh. So over the last 3 or 4 years, we have seen reported, of course, these massive rise in UFO sightings. And all of a sudden, like 2 months ago, right in November, right after the sightings in New York in October, where they hovered for half the day in front of everyone in broad daylight on national news, they left. I mean, there have been no sightings reported. Yeah, check it out. Go to Google yourself. Google it. Bing it. Yahoo it. Ask it. Look it up. UFO sightings are nowhere to be found on YouTube that are recent. You're going to find some back in 2010, but nothing in the last 3 months anywhere except for local places like maybe Trout Lake. But believe me, the news media doesn't go there because it's so common it's no longer news. There's been a vacancy of off-world craft in our skies. I want to know what you think about that. Is it getting too hot in the kitchen? In the last few months of last year, we concluded that off-world craft, or inner-world craft, as some would call them, maybe they've been here a long time and they just live in another neighborhood, like under the ocean, they seemed to show up whenever they pleased. In fact, it seemed that they were as public as they wanted to be. That's the conclusion that we came up with Nick Pope and Dan Willis on the program just a few weeks ago. And there really are tens of millions of people who want them to be more public. Okay? We want to see another alien. Besides the brain-eating aliens that we are seeing in practically every sci-fi movie of late. If it isn't V, it's Skyline, or it's, you know, Aliens versus Predator. It's on and on, like they're trying to prepare us for something, or laying the groundwork for some Pentagon Wars R Us thing where they need our money for more and better weapons. But now it seems they're just gone. We thought we were on the threshold of a major global first contact, and then they just left. They went home or underwater or wherever they are hiding on this planet where we cannot see them. I just flew halfway across the country twice recently. And I never closed my eyes. I kept my face pressed against that window the whole time. I had the best view from 34,000 feet. Daytime, nighttime, guess what? Nothing. What happened? Did they give up hope? Have you given up hope? After decades of research and watching and hoping and dreaming about it, are you ready to give up on them? Do you think that there really are no UFOs, that they're all American-made special weapons systems that we built with our dark money, and they're just flying around testing it, and that's why the military doesn't go up to check it out because, hey, they're ours. And that's why the news media doesn't go up because they can't get military clearance to do it? These are great questions. I would like to have your input. 530-413-4511. 530-413-4515. And you can also chat me at Skype. X2-radio is my handle on Skype. So come on. Tell me what you're thinking. What's going on? Now, if you've seen one recently, I want to hear about that too. And I don't mean a light. I don't mean, you know, flashing lights. I don't mean some triangular ship. You saw blackout stars in the night sky. I need something more than that, okay? I'm like my friend Stanton Friedman. You know, UFOs are real. We know it. You know it. They know it. But we want a little bit more, okay? We want to hear what's going on out there. And if you haven't seen any where you normally see any in the last 9 weeks or so, let's hear about that too, because not really sure what's going on here. Why the darkness? Why the calm? Why do we have SOHO picking up a sunspot, 1147, on the far side of the sun, that's just snappling and cracking and popping, yeah, like the cereal, blowing coronal mass ejections out into space away from Earth. And then as it nears the eastern limb and it comes around and we're all ready with our cameras and our coronoscopes, nothing. It goes quiet. It sits there and minds its own business as it goes across the face of the sun pointing to Earth. One of my friends and I were talking about Nibiru and the possibility of this elliptical, highly elliptical planet heading our way. And they just up and asked me, do you think it's real? Do you think there's really a planet out there heading our way that we can't see? I said, oh, yeah. It's absolutely possible that a planet could be coming toward us that we can't see. No doubt about it. Let me justify this statement to you. Recently, and I say recently in the last couple of years, we launched the Kepler mission. Now, the Kepler was a probe that was sent out into space to look for planets. Now, prior to that, we had a system of looking for planets. We call it perturbation. This is where we actually stare at stars for long periods of time, and we watch and measure very carefully the wobble in those stars. Well, the amplitude of that wobble and the frequency of that wobble kind of tells us the size and the orbit of planets that are revolving that sun, that are actually tugging on it, as though you were leaning back, swinging a bucket full of water. You would lean back to counteract that weight. Well, that's what the sun does too. It's tugged in the direction that the planet is pointing at the time gravitationally. The other thing that we use is a light loss method. Now, should we get lucky enough to be on the plane view, that is P-L-A-N-E, the planar view of this solar system out there, where the planet is actually going to cross in front of the face of that star, then we measure the loss of light from that star when that planet does do that, and we can estimate the circumference of that planet by the amount of light that's blocked. Those are the methods we had, folks. And we were up to, 40, 50 planets maybe that we'd identified out there, different planets around different solar systems. That's it. And that was with perturbation theory, and that was long, long hours, days, months of looking at certain stars to see how they wobble. Kepler mission has successfully discovered well over 200 planets, some of them in the sweet spot, like Earth. Not too hot, where all the water is steam and the surface is perhaps molten, and not too far away, where the planet's a solid block of ice. In the sweet spot, in the golden zone, in the life zone. And astrobiologists are excited about these planets because they know what DNA does as it scatters itself around the universe in frozen chunks of ice, cometary heads and various meteorites that go blazing into these planets as little seed cups. They know what happens. When they fall upon fertile ground, they sprout and they grow, and they'll reach some kind of ecology where they reach a balance. One species will wipe out another species, or will come into some symbiotic relationship or some ecological balance with each other, and life will survive. It will begin. And one life supports another life, and over millions of years, it becomes something amazing. It becomes enticing to us to go visit, to go see, to go photograph, to go take samples of, or maybe even colonize. It really becomes exciting. But keep in mind, even Kepler uses the same methods. We don't go for the planets. We go for the stars. We head for the stars. And we use Kepler to look for the planets around those stars. That's how we find them. That's how it's done, people. Nibiru is not of that class. Nibiru, for all intents and purposes, is what we call a free-floating planet. A free-floating planet appears to not be orbiting around anything. It doesn't have a home star, unless toroidal or torsional gravity theory has some merit, and the jury is still out, but the evidence is interesting, that our sun is the sun around which Nibiru orbits. And keep in mind that our sun is a binary star. By binary, I mean that our star revolves around another star, and that star is Sirius. The star, S-I-R-I-U-S, Sirius the star, is a binary star with our star, which we call the sun. We don't know what the planets around Sirius call our sun, but we call that one Sirius. That's why it's been in the same place for over 11,000 years. 4 precessional sections it has been in the same place. The pyramids are still aligned with Sirius as they were when they were first built. Some say 11,000 years ago, the Sphinx, the most recent really legitimate scientific dating, is 35,000 years ago. Yeah, Sirius is still lined up with our star because we are revolving around it. So it is quite possible that Nibiru is in orbit around both stars as kind of a big figure eight racetrack kind of orbit. Highly elliptical and maybe not even involved in the plane of the planets in our solar system. And if that's the case, acts like a free floating planet for all intents and purposes because the orbit is so large. Now, if that's the case, we're not going to see it. You won't see it. You won't see it with the Palomar scope. You won't see it because it's not in the same place. It's moving. It's not like the asteroid belt where we can look at Phobos or various ones of the large rocks in the asteroid belt. It is large, but it doesn't put off its own light. It may put off a little gentle glow reflected from various stars that have to be bouncing off of it, but we're not going to see it until our star bounces off of it. Yeah, until our sunlight begins to bounce off Nibiru, guess what? It's not showing up in the night sky. You're not going to see it with your 12-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain. It's not on the charts. It's not a simple idea of just pointing it out there somewhere and looking at it for a couple of hours. It doesn't work that way. What you have to do is take a segment of space and you have to live with it for a couple of years. That means you have to photograph it every single clear night you have with your motor drive, with its crosshairs on exactly the same spot in the sky. And what you will see as you put those pictures, one after the other, after the other, after the other, in kind of a motion picture, is you will see the bodies that are moving. That's how comets are found. That's how these giant asteroids and things that aren't lit up by the sun yet are found, because you can see them moving incrementally across space over time. That's how Nibiru will be found. Maybe, maybe they won't see it until the light of our sun is on it. And if it's moving through space at a rate of speed that would be commensurate with that kind of orbit, Earth revolves around our sun at about 18.5 miles per second. Mercury revolves quite a bit faster, and Pluto and Uranus and Neptune a little bit slower. This doesn't apply to galaxies, however. The stars in the outer part of the galaxy revolve around the center of the galaxy at the same speed the stars in the center of the galaxy revolve around it. Why is that? Well, because the stars that you see are only a small fraction of the mass that makes up a galaxy. There's literally 94 to 95% of the, or 93 to 94% of the rest of the galaxy is matter we cannot see, but is very gravitationally involved in the rotation of the galaxy. And so, relative to the mass of the planet, the stars are so small, they do revolve at the same speed around the center at the outside of the rim as they do near the center. Not so like solar systems. Newton's laws don't apply when you start throwing a whole bunch more matter into the equation, which doesn't show up, but it's there because the results of the equation are irrefutable. If that's the case, then Nibiru is hauling butt out there in space. It could be going at 0.1, 0.2 light speed. And if that's the case, it could be 3 months away and well out of sight. It could be a month away and still out of sight. It could pop into view, literally. And we talk about this in the second volume of The Arc of Millions of Years. It could literally pop into view 3 weeks before arrival. And if that happens, if we have another gravitational algorithm, another gravitational input into the mass of our solar system, then we have changed the equation. We begin to move. We begin to perturb not only the sun, we begin to perturb planets in the solar system. And that's what was predicted by Sitchin when he translated the Sumerian texts. This is what he was talking about. This cyclical appearance of another planet has cataclysmic results upon the solar system itself. This is what Emmanuel Velikovsky in his book Worlds in Collision was talking about, and for which he was excoriated and later vindicated. So, really, from an astrophysical point of view, from a cosmological point of view, is it possible? Yea, verily. Let's hear from Scott in Florida. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Brooks. I had a reading a while back, channeled reading with Galexis. He used to be on BBS radio. And I had asked specifically about Nibiru because there was so much mystery about this planet. And what I was told was that at one time the planet was a part of Sirius, but was banished for whatever reason from Sirius. And there are inhabitants on the planet.
Interesting.
And mostly what they feel are two emotions, fear and anger. And they're of the Zeta origin, supposedly. How the planet stays warm in the cold space, I don't know.
Most planets, including Earth, have a highly uranium type core. And I would say that most worlds out there, because of the oddity of being the perfect distance away from the perfect kind of sun. Most worlds don't have their inhabitants on the surface. They have their inhabitants under the surface. So that's how they would survive on Nibiru. They would definitely survive inside, which we basically do. I mean, we're outside 15% of the time. That's it. The rest of the time, we're indoors.
For the world is hollow and I have touched the sky, a Star Trek episode where that was the case. It was a planet going through space that was a spaceship, essentially. The sky was a material that protected insulated the planet, so to speak. So that would be along the same lines of that. I was also looking through the ephemeris at 2012. I have an ephemeris here, December 21st, just to see if there's anything really profound happening then. There have been astrologers talking about it. You've probably had some on the show even. But in general, I think the most profound thing is coming up on that day would be the sun in conjunction with Pluto, but that's not necessarily just that day. That gets more and more, or that shifts back and forth depending on Pluto and the sun, so on and so forth. In fact, it's closer in November than it is in December. There are a few other things going on, like Venus opposite Jupiter and sun trine Saturn and Saturn trine Neptune and Jupiter square Neptune and Mars trine Uranus and, of course, the sun, the moon moving so quickly. It's a square on that day moving toward a trine, a square being 90 degrees moving toward 120 degrees. And then there's a moon-Mercury trine and a Mercury-Venus conjunction. But astrologically, what's happening within our system isn't that profound. But I would be, you know, now that you mentioned Sirius, it opens up a whole other door. It's like, how do the planets, if there are any around Sirius, impact us? We're going around Sirius. Those planets should be impacting us too, technically, in a way. Even far, I mean, to stretch it a bit, but I mean, we're impacted, or events on the Earth supposedly have some, or influenced somewhat by the planets, but would that not be something scientists and astronomers and astrologers to look into, is not only the impact of the planets within our system, but how the planets in other neighboring systems that are real close to us might impact and influence things that are going on. I mean, to get kind of out there, I mean, we're kind of getting spacey, if you'll pardon the expression, but we're kind of, you know, I'm kind of looking at all that, and what do you think of that?
Well, NASA understands it, because when we launched our deep space probes, we realized we didn't have enough fuel to, you know, get it up to the speeds to get outside the heliosphere, and so we used the gravitational bodies of other planets to sort of slingshot that craft from place to place, sort of like a, you know, crack the whip. And of course, the spaceship perturbed the planet, but so infinitesimally small that it was unnoticeable. But the planet really perturbed the spacecraft and slung it out in deeper into space. It is not inconceivable that Nibiru slingshots around Sirius, which we can see, and on the other side is Sirius A, which we cannot see, which is even more dense, has more matter in it than the Sirius that we see with our eyes, and comes whipping back around, heading for our solar system. Mm-hmm. It isn't inconceivable that this kind of orbit exists. So Nibiru could make the trip back and forth between the two planets, or between the two stars.
And we're talking, it's 7.3 light years from our sun, correct me if I'm wrong, Sirius.
Yeah, something that's like right. That. It just a skunch over 7 light years. So it's something like 0.1 light speed, or, you know, somewhere around 200, 300,000 miles an hour. It would take about 3,600 years to go the round.
Which isn't really a lot. I mean, they've, you know, when a light year is, what, a trillion miles? I mean, now that we know the national deficit and the debt and so on and so forth, a trillion doesn't seem so much anymore. I mean, it's kind of like, oh, that's doable.
Well, the interesting thing is that cosmologically speaking, it is possible. And when we're talking about planetary alignments, and whether, you know, I'm talking with Michio Kaku or I'm talking with other mainstream astronomers or astrophysicists, the alignment that they talk about publicly is the alignment of the Earth and the Sun with the center of the galaxy. That occurs every year. And that's no big deal. And if there are effects from it, it's difficult to see. What we're talking about is the alignment that was drawn on the tomb lid of Pakal in Palenque. And that is that this rift in the Milky Way, which is this area that really has no light. There's so much gravity in it, it appears that light cannot escape it. And the Earth with the Sun on the other side of it, not with it, is an alignment that only occurs once every 25,000, 26,000 years. That is the alignment that the Maya were talking about. And they were saying that should the Sun have a solar flare during that period of time, that it will not reach, you know, a few hundred or thousand diameters of Earth into space. It will reach thousands, hundreds of thousands of Earth diameters into space, and that those particles, those proton counts, won't go up to 12 or 14 or 15 protons per cubic centimeter. They'll be in the thousands per cubic centimeter. And if that happens, they're going to get picked up by copper wire, which is exactly what happened in 1859, which is why telegraph operators were electrocuted, shocked, thrown to the ground, equipment caught on fire. And that was just DC, you know, wires up on a pole. We start doing it with our power grid that we have, literally hundreds of thousands of miles of high-tension lines hooked to step-up and step-down transformers in every city block of every nation. And you're going to see huge effects, because you start throwing 100,000 volts per foot onto a copper wire, and then you send that to a transformer. There's no way that transformer can take that. It's going to melt down.
There's also an astrologer, Sam Jeppy, who I've been following. He's a Vedic astrologer in San Francisco, GEPPI, and he's written an ebook on 2012. He's talking about what you're talking about with the galactic alignment and so on and so forth, and looking directly into Sagittarius, which is the center of our Milky Way, supposedly, and the ramifications there, Sagittarius being about spiritual growth, I would say. I mean, that's what the sign is really known for. It's the love of nature and spiritual growth and making the choice to grow spiritually and freedom being valued above all else, plus the influence of the age of Aquarius. Some say we're already in it. Some say we're moving into it. Aquarius being very independent, very individual. The focus is on individuality in Aquarius. The focus is on high principles and following those principles and taking responsibility for one's own personal reality, whereas the age of Pisces was a different slant. For those who are Christian, it is through Christ that you manifest your reality. In the age of Aquarius, you manifest your reality directly. It's like you are doing it, and you're at that level where you become aware that you are manifesting your reality directly.
That was Christ's teachings anyway.
Say again?
That was Jesus's teachings anyway.
Yes, to craft. Do it yourself. Now, I think right. People have become kind of, it's become through the church, through the past, through the, you know, that sort of thing, as opposed to, you know, that's what has become where Christianity has gone. But, you know, and there are those who say that Christ was Pisces, but his birthday really wasn't December 25th, but it was in March sometime, but I don't know exactly when that was either.
No, nobody pays taxes in December, okay? I mean, come on, if you're gonna give the firstlings of the flock and you know all that, it's all done in April. Come on, there's no taxes in the middle of the winter. Everybody knows that. And of late, and I think maybe more in the last 5 years than any other time, churches haven't really lost their popularity, but they've changed their function. Now, instead of the conduit toward eternal salvation, they now have become more sanctuaries to personal healing. They've become places where people can come together and help one another, which is exactly what they're supposed to do. Not where they are so much putting people in fear, where if you stop coming to church, by the way, you're going to go to hell. And if you're going to be there, you better put some money in that cup or you're also going to go to hell. You know, so it become less of that and more of the social support and physical support. And it's a great place to go and resonate by singing the songs and holding hands and focusing on love and peace and those things. And that's why, you know, churches do serve their function. And I think even the Vatican has grown away from the all-powerful edict of salvation. You work out your own salvation before God. In fact, the judgment wherewith you are judged is not from the priest. It's from your own state of energy and being, which is an instantaneous change.
And speaking of black triangles, not that you want to hear about it, but in my experience, I don't see them when I go outside. I see them when I'm either in meditation or dreaming. So that's what I do. And the last one had like two little red windows on the side of it, which they probably don't look that way, but that's probably personally symbolic to me. That has some meaning to me in my unconscious mind. But two windows together, like the front of a jet would have, along those lines, one on one side, one on the other of the craft. And that was the latest. But most of the others that I've had, you know, makes me question. Some of them might be Air Force of the future or from another planet or who knows.
Well, the military ones, they're not going to be hanging around the window looking out at you. I think they're going to be concentrating on whatever mission it is they're flying. That's my take on it. And the reason I picked this subject to start out tonight is because I had the strangest dream this morning. I was at this kind of an outdoor event. It had to be warm because there were strings of lights and people were outside celebrating and there were, you know, places cooking food and bands and all kinds of stuff. And it was, late in the evening. And I said to somebody, hey, where's the moon? And they said, oh, the moon's right over there. And sure enough, there it was on the horizon, you know, nice and large and almost orangish as it was setting in the west. And I turned around and looked to the east and said, then what is that? And I pointed to it, and on the opposite side, on the eastern side, was another crescent. Nobody noticed it. So, wait a minute, if the moon's over there, then, yeah, what is that? And there it was, just a little bit of light leaking around the earth, lighting up the edge of it. It was hiding in the shadow of the earth. And then I woke up, so that's why I started talking about this tonight.
Speaking of the moon, do you have anything to say about the movie about, it was called The Moon, or Moon, rather, came out last year, I believe. It looked kind of like Solaris. There was a movie a while back called Solaris. It looked kind of along those lines. It was more like a psychological than science fiction, but I don't know if you saw that or not.
Gee, how did I miss that? I don't think I saw it. I mean, I'm an avid movie watcher. If it's halfway decent, I'm going to do it on big screen. And if it's not, I'm going to rent it, or even worse, I'm going to watch it online.
It didn't come out in all theaters. It only came out in selective theaters. And
it was called Moon.
Moon.
Okay. I'm going to check it out. I'll give you a review on it. I haven't seen it. I haven't seen it. I went and saw Green Hornet this weekend, and slapstick B-movie, but and the acting was marginal, but the storyline was so much fun. It was just a fun movie. It was kind of like Galaxy Quest. Galaxy Quest was an amazingly fun ride. Super well directed, very good acting, and it was just a fun movie.
Galaxy Quest.
Yeah, there was one with Tim Allen where they were actors playing a space.
I remember.
And they got taken up into space by real aliens because they'd been viewing the historical records. That was a fun movie.
And Nichelle Nichols is going to be on NPR tomorrow night talking about, I think she does this annually, talking about the impact of Dr. King on her life and asking her to stay on the show. She was going to leave the show after the first year of Star Trek back in 67.
Ah.
She chose to stay on, and she will be talking tomorrow sometime on NPR. I saw that on the Star Trek news. So anyway, I'll get off and let you on with the show.
All right, excellent. Thanks so much for the call. Have a wonderful time down there in Florida. I might be down there in a couple of weeks showing off my electric truck.
Well, I've told people about the company, and I've told people that the banks need to fund your company so that we can get this show on the road, because I'm sure there'll be people down here who'd line up for an electric truck.
Well, I know they'll accept the deposits, but I don't know about funding. I think the funding is going to come from Europe. We're very close now. United States has been kind of vacuous as far as investment into green technology. Went from $30 billion in 2009 to $2 billion in 2010. So they're pretty much out of the investment business. It's going to be Europeans or Asians that come in. And I really don't want the Asians to get involved in investing, but we'll get it started. It's going to happen.
Talk to you later.
All right, bye-bye. All right, we're going to take a quick break, listen to just a little bit of Sarah McLachlan, because she has a good song called Witness. We'll play that. By the way, I've had a couple of people comment that I'm cutting off the bumper music and just kind of preserving the speaking part of it, and that way when you're listening to the archives, you don't have to listen to the music. But I've had a lot of people write me and say, hey, I want to hear the rest of the music. So I'm going to go ahead and start the song, and then I will start the second hour as quickly as possible so that you don't miss too much of the song. All right? So here we go. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away.
Make me a witness. Take me out of darkness, out of doubt. I won't weigh it down with good intention.
And welcome back to X Squared Radio. By the way, we're coming to you live from Mississippi, about 80 miles from the Gulf of Mexico. AccuWindow forecast, 55 degrees and cloudy, going to start raining in the morning. The rest of the country got blanketed with white from coast to coast. 48 states got snow. I don't think that's ever happened before. A lot of people have comments like, yeah, global warming, right? Well, people, these are the weather patterns that are actually predicted to come forward during periods of global warming. But it does, it doesn't necessarily warm the planet worldwide. In fact, since 1998, we've actually seen a mean drop in global temperature. But that being said, we are seeing extremes in the weather, and that is without doubt. All you have to do is look down under and see what's going on. It is an ocean of red mud, waist deep, water and trash, and things that have been uprooted and torn down in ways that have never been seen on that continent, not as long as modern man has been there. And then you see literally coast to coast, every single state of the continent getting snow. And you begin to see that there are extremes happening all around us. And they're happening, and the rate of acceleration of this is increasing. That is to say, they're happening more often and in greater degree. So it does take a rocket scientist, it takes a meteorologist living in your house, or a geologist living in your house, to tell you, well, yeah, okay, maybe something is happening, okay? So I suggest that you are prepared for this. And I think this preparation comes in two different ways. One is the easy way, and that is to take a few extra dollars as you get your refund checks back, or you are one of the millions now going back to work as the unemployment rate seems to be rebounding back away from 9.9 to maybe 9.89. Somebody's going back to work. As you go back to work, one of the first things you should put on your to-do list is to put together an emergency preparing kit. I recommend starting out with a 72-hour kit. This is something that literally you can grab in your pajamas, head out the front door, and you can live, not just survive, can live and take care of yourself for 3 days. It may take you 3 days to walk somewhere. It may take 3 days for the power to come back on. It may take 3 days for emergency crews to get buses or boats or whatever kind of relief needs to come into you. And you need to take care of yourself. And if you don't want to take care of yourself, that's fine. Take care of the ones you love. Take care of your kids, your grandkids, maybe the elderly neighbor that you have next door to you. And how do you do that? Well, you don't just go get a few extra bags of Lay's and a couple extra cases of Bud Light. Come on, be serious here. No. You get a hold of 1-800-PREPARE.com, okay? That's the affiliate that we have vetted, and I have been through dozens and dozens, perhaps over 100 suppliers of emergency preparedness gear. There are lots and lots and lots of them on the web. I've talked to dozens of them. I have made them offers. I have provided them time. None of them care anything about you, but we do. And so we were looking for an affiliate that cared about you, that wanted to reach you, and we found that affiliate in 1-800-PREPARE.com. My friend Paul Faust, former firefighter, and his EMT buddies put together this website because at 9/11, they found in New York, people didn't know how to prepare. They just didn't. They had maybe a one-day supply of food in the fridge in their condo on the 28th floor. They didn't know how to prepare. And so they put together this website for the average person, not somebody that's going out and buying 1,000 pounds of wheat and somebody that has a wheat grinder and prepare all this stuff, not that person. I'm talking about the person that needs a kit in the back of their BMW, or they need something in the hall closet that they can grab and head out of the house. You know, the average person that lives in an apartment or lives in a basement or lives in a small house somewhere. Maybe they don't have the room to store thousands of pounds of food. And they need something that'll last because they don't want to take the time to rotate it and date it and take care of it and maintain it. Cans of beans and rice and blah, 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 all that stuff. Well, this is the site for you. A lot of this food will last for 25 years. That's called set it and forget it. Spend less than $100 and rest, because you know when the glass starts breaking and the sirens go off, you can head for the shelter and you can take care of yourself. You are no longer a burden upon the FEMA of the world, the disaster preparedness people, the emergency management people. You could take care of yourself. Do that. And as you check out at 1-800-PREPARE.com, put in my name, Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S, in the coupon code, and you'll get an extra 10% off. That's from my friends. Now, a lot of you have written me and asked me about Merkaba meditation training, because you've read the book, you've listened to the audio book, you've heard us talk about it here on the radio program. We've had Maureen St. Germain, my teacher, on this program talking about it. It is a very efficient type of meditation. It doesn't take all day. 17 breaths and you're in. Literally. 17 inhale, exhales, and you're in. This is a working man's meditation. And then I develop the 18th breath, which is added on top of that. It is sanctioned, and it will help you listen to the universe so that you know when to jump, when to call, when to write, when to make that move, as part of making the law of attraction work in your life. Well, the good news, February 3rd through 5th, we're going to have Merkaba meditation training in Concord, North Carolina. Now, if you want to learn more about that, you have to go to the website. You can go to marinesaintgermain.com. You can go to rememberingthefuturebook.com, and you can click on the brochure and the registration link there, or you can go to xsquaredradio.com and you can click on the same two links there. So there are lots of ways to get there. It's affordable, it's local, you can get there. It's central to 70% of the population of the United States. We're going to teach you the things that you can't figure out from reading the book or listening to the CD. You will be making some minor little mistakes. We want to help you adjust that and perfect it so it can work in your lives. And lots of you have written and asked, and that's how you do it. Now, I'm going to send this out in my newsletter here this week. So you're also going to get it by newsletter. If you haven't signed up for the newsletter, you can do that at xsquaredradio.com right there at the top. It's free. Sign up for it. You're going to get a newsletter about once a month. It's going to be 3 or 4 pages of really great news and thoughts from me and some links, and this is going to be one of them this month. So do that, and we will be back in 40 seconds with Hour 2 of X Squared Radio. Program of X Squared Radio is the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. And one of the greatest mysteries of the earth, going back way, way back, is the mystery of the Nephilim. We've talked about it from time to time, but I want to talk about a specific aspect of the Nephilim this hour. And that is that, you know, they were numbered only 200, and they came to this planet. They had an agenda. And that agenda is to take over the world. Now, obviously, 200, no matter how powerful they are, they can't take over by force. That's just not going to work. Humans proliferate. We're smart. We adapt. We're uncontrollable. And maybe controlling by force is not the way that they want to control the world. And in fact, it isn't. And so what they've done actually is they've crafted a plan which they call alchemy. Now, alchemy, if you look that up, you're going to spend days and you're going to go down so many blind alleys, it's going to blind you. Alchemy is this. The core of it is this. Alchemy is turning base metals into gold. Or, to make it even simpler, to make it pure, it's turning the worthless into something valuable. Now, if you can do that, if you can take something that's common, like dirt, and you can change it, parking lot gravel, and you can change it into something valuable that people can exchange their labors for, like if you're a dentist or a doctor or a mechanic or a farmer, you can exchange your labors for this parking lot gravel, and then you can go somewhere else and take that parking lot gravel and get the things that you want, like shoes or sugar or DVDs or a new car, because that exchange, that contractual exchange between one labor system and a good system or another labor system is uniform. Well, in the last 150 years, that has really taken a turn. But if we go back to medieval times, to the times of the Crusades. Now, in the Crusades, yes, you had warriors that were, you know, trying to get Jerusalem back and, of course, punish those who crucified Christ, yada, 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 all of that. But you also had pilgrims that were going from Europe down to Jerusalem to have a pilgrimage, to have a Mecca, to go there and be in Jerusalem and come back. Well, if you're traveling from Austria or France or Belgium or, you know, someplace like that, and you're on horseback or walking or on a wagon, some kind of caravan, and you leave from there, you're going to have whatever the currency is there, or you're going to have something universal like gold or jewels or silver or something like that. And along the way, you're going to meet with every nefarious group that you can imagine. You're going to meet unscrupulous businessmen who are unfair with the way they trade with you. They charge you too much for a room or for food, and if you don't pay it, you starve, or worse, they just find you alongside the road and kill you and take your money, because that's what they really want, is the money. They want that value. Well, the Knights Templar had an interesting plan. The Freemasons had this idea of alchemy, which they had carried forward, which was taught to them by the Nephilim anciently. In fact, it might even be assumed, and not too far off the mark if you go by the record that's left in Rosslyn Chapel, that the Nephilim were involved with the Freemasons, which go way, way, way back before the 1400s, which is when the English claim that Freemasonry started. No, it goes way back to the Temple Builders of Tyre, which, you, as you'll remember, are the builders that Solomon hired to build his temple. So it goes, they were building these kinds of things way before Solomon. That's where they got their reputation, because they knew how to build this stuff. These Templars were the ones that knew about this alchemical secret of turning the worthless into something valuable. And so here's what the Templars did. What they did is they formed treasuries along the way in neighborhoods and in cities. And people could come, especially in France, could come and deposit their gold. They could deposit the things that they had that were of real value, and they could exchange them for, and I'm not kidding, it was called a check. C-H-E-Q-U-E, a check, all right? And this check had a code on it, a special code that only the bank, only the archive or the holder of the goods and the person who'd put the goods in knew the secret of. It was worthless to anybody else, absolutely worthless. It was a scroll or a piece of animal skin or something. It was a check. And then the pilgrim could go along their path toward Jerusalem, and when they needed money to check into the hotel or to buy food or supplies or fix a wagon wheel or whatever, they would just simply go to the blacksmith, go to the cobbler, go to the cooper, go to whoever they needed to, and they would just access the local Templar and withdraw funds, real funds, local currency, using their check until the value of that check was exhausted. Now, I've always asked the question, how did the Templars in France communicate to the Templars in Spain that this person had actually made a deposit? How did the Templars in Spain know the code that the Templars in France knew? Yeah, really interesting stuff, huh? These are good questions. We do bring them up in the first volume of the Ark of Millions of Years. But believe me, the system worked. And the robbers were foiled. And people made their way to Jerusalem and made their way all the way back to their hometown without losing their money. And the wealth of the Templars rose so fast and was so incredibly powerful that James the Just became infuriated and demanded, raised his army and demanded that they open the banks, open the archives, open the storage places, and give them all of the gold. And so they raided them. And they raided them and they raided them and they raided them. And guess what they found? Nothing. There was nothing in there. Those people had put their wealth in there, and the Templars had exchanged to them a check. And somehow they managed to spirit away all of the real wealth. Well, flash forward to the Revolutionary War, Washington. Washington is running an army, General Washington. Not alone, mind you, there were other even smarter generals, like General Putnam. General Putnam was way more successful than Washington was, and much smarter. County was named after him in Tennessee, Putnam County. However, Putnam was short, and Putnam was ugly, and Putnam had curly hair. And Putnam, he wasn't presidential, but Washington was huge. He was very tall and very big, and he had that colonial royalty about him. And he was kingly in his mannerisms. Not a very smart general. All his men almost starved to death in Valley Forge through his poor planning, but he was a Freemason. And he needed a way to finance the war. And so the Solomon brothers in Jerusalem came through, and they literally gave the colonial army all their money. They died paupers in Jerusalem. And through Freemasonry, through this ancient link, the money flowed into the colonial army, and they were able to finance themselves enough to win. Well, it seems that way. Gee, it just blows your mind when you have an army that outguns you, has more men, has more resources, has more uniforms, has battle-hardened troops from all over the world, and they're coming into your country by the tens of thousands, and they're facing you down on your own turf, and they outnumber you, and they outgun you, and they outman you, and they outthink you, and you still beat them. Was it God? Was it Providence that stepped in the way with lightning and disease and wild animals attacking the Brits? No, not at all. Was it the hide-behind-the-tree tactics that are talked about in American history books? How this ragtag colonial army, skin and bones, rife with disease and weakness because of poor nutrition, could stand up against the battle-hardened, well-financed British army that controlled the world? Nonsense. Absolute nonsense. What won the Revolutionary War was nothing, nothing but Freemasonry. It was the fact that the officers that held the rank that ran the field operations for the Brits were Freemasons. And Washington, and they say Jefferson, there's no actual proof, but he never denied it, and other leaders in the U.S. colonial government were Freemasons. They would not fight against one another. The ones in Britain knew the prophecy of the New Jerusalem. They knew that America, this place, fit that prophecy so well they would not fight against it. They would not conquer the colonialists because they wanted the colony to succeed. And that is how Freemasonry won the war. Well, it got a foothold. It began to grow. And the American dollar, with all of its Freemason symbolism on it, became the spine of currency in the world. But not so in recent decades. In the last 45 years, the dollar has gone up, the dollar's gone down, and down, and down. And then they took the dollar off the gold standard. And then, in the 40s and 50s, they took the dollar off the silver standard. You remember the movie The Wizard of Oz? That's what it was about, my friends. It was about the fact that they had taken the silver out of the money. There was no silver standard anymore. That's why Dorothy's shoes were silver. They were not ruby, like you saw in the movie. In the book, Frank L. Baum made the shoes silver. He said, if you'll click your heels together three times, you can go home. He was implying in this satire of American economy and politics that if we would return to the silver standard, we could go home. Now you understand how important it is. Once the value was taken out of the certificates, all you basically had was a piece of printed linen paper. Now, I dare say that's a lot less, worth a lot less than a chunk of lead that you're trying to turn into gold. It's worth even less than that. And today, we are not with paper. We are with ones and zeros on a little magnetic strip on a piece of plastic that we swipe across a reader. You never actually see money. You never actually see dollars. The stuff that you earn digitally goes into your account and digitally comes out of your account to pay your cell phone bill or pay for your tires or your gasoline. How many of you, come on, let me see a show of hands. How many of you pump your own gas and go in and pay with cash? That's what I thought. That's what I thought. Most of you swipe the plastic card, especially the young people. My kids, they would do away with cash in a New York second. Why? Because all they have to carry with them is the plastic. That's it. Swipe and go. Some places you don't even have to sign. Like if you go to McDonald's, you don't even have to sign. Amounts under $25, it's optional. Just swipe and go. Just swipe and go. You don't have to sign for anything. Interestingly enough, pay for parking at the airport. Just swipe and go. You never have to sign anything. They're making it so easy, it's crazy. Well, now we get to the point where you've got to get the value down to the point where another currency could take over, right? Something that really has value. Something that's really under control. Something that can really command. Now you see a very strange situation. And this is one of the mysteries of the earth. This is one of the mysteries of the Nephilim. This is one of the mysteries of Freemasonry, of alchemy. We have taken something absolutely worthless, and we've made it a fair exchange for something that you are doing that is worth very much, by the way. Some of you are making a lot of money out there, $40,000, $50,000, $70,000, $100,000 a year, maybe more. Maybe we have very wealthy listeners to X Squared Radio. You're doing a job for which you are being paid a fair exchange in ones and zeros. And you are able to still exchange those ones and zeros for things that you want that are of value. A house, a car, clothes, jewels, travel, whatever it is that you need or that you want if you make enough money, you can exchange your ones and zeros for. That's fine. Unless you're trying to buy something in the UK. Unless you're trying to buy something in China. Or unless you're in China trying to sell something. Or unless you're selling a book in Australia. Well, then the exchange rate gets you. Yeah, money floats up and down, values back and forth. It's very confusing. And there are money changers that are making trillions of dollars off of buying dollars and selling dinars and then buying rubles and then yuan and then yen and hundreds of times a day. There are automatic programs that do it. You know how much interest they make a year? 9%? No, not 9%. I got 17% over there. No, it's not even 17%. Would you believe me if I told you a minimum of 50% and it's probably closer to 95%? Yeah. How would you like to make 95% on your investment? Well, you can. You could take $5 million. I know you don't have $5 million, but some of you might. You could take $5 million, put it into this automated trading program that will do nothing but trade currencies several times a day with all kinds of safety stops where it will stop trading if it looks like you're going to lose and you'll cash out at various times and get back in. I guarantee you, they guarantee you, within a year's time, that $5 million, you will have made $2.5 million interest. Yeah, that's a heck of a living, isn't it? That's a heck of a living. And how much money's in the system? I would tell you $5 million wouldn't even buy a single token. $50 million wouldn't buy a single token. $100 million, you might get a Christmas card. We're talking billions of dollars. $500 billion, $700 billion floating in these cash accounts that are exchanging currencies multiple times a week. It's infinitesimal sometimes. 0.2% here, 0.15% here, 1% there. Little jumps up and down, but dozens and dozens of times a month. And these computer programs generate cash by exchanging these currencies back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And you're constantly buying low, selling high, buying low, selling high. And you rarely, if ever, lose because the computer programs have it figured out. This is alchemy. And it's getting ready to end. It's getting ready to end. Because what happens is eventually you play the game until something collapses. Now, I'm going to share a couple of news analysts' opinions of this so that you can see this isn't just me coming up with this. Far from it, there's a lot going on here. And there are audio clips that go with this, and I'm going to play this for you. Just so you know, it's real. This is what's going on out there, okay? This is Peter Schiff, and he's talking about gold at what price? Oh, my goodness. You think you bought gold at $5 or $30 or $300? I'll tell you something. Gold doesn't go up in price. It doesn't go up in value. Gold is always the same value. Why? Because gold is gold. If you bought it at $300, it was worth $300. Today, it might be worth $1,200. It's still worth exactly the same. The gold buys exactly the same at $300 as it does $1,200. The gold doesn't change value. That's the thing that has the value in our world because it is a precious metal. The paper, the dollars, the ones and zeros are what the traders are making it. And they have now traded it to the point where it's about to collapse. I want you to listen to this. Pay close attention. Here we go.
And clients in 1999, I think it's the first time I started buying them.
How much
and
was probably, gold per ounce back?
Well, gold was under 300. It was a two, you know, and it was near the peak of the NASDAQ, and when it really started to get ridiculous, and gold stocks were ultra cheap back then, and I started buying them. And then I started selling and recommending physical precious metals, and I bought myself both gold, silver, platinum, probably in 2001, I think I started selling it. And now, you know, we sell a tremendous, I probably sell more physical bullion per month today than I used to do in brokerage business when I first started, you know, in 2000. So we're selling a lot of gold.
Where does it go from here?
A lot higher. I mean, first of all, look where oil is. Oil is now at $120 a barrel. So if you look at the relationship that gold has to oil, you would expect it to be close to 10 to 1. So with $120 barrel oil, you should see gold around 1,200 an ounce. And I think it'll get there before the end of the year.
Help me understand this, though, Peter, and pretend this is the average investor asking. What do you do? Gold is this kind of thing that you buy the bars of it or you buy the physical gold and you don't do anything with
it.
You just hold it.
Yeah, gold is money. And money retains its value. That's the good thing about money. The problem is what everybody is using that they think is money, dollars, doesn't retain its value because Ben Bernanke is printing it like crazy. In fact, you know, there was news that came out today on Freddie Mac, these huge losses that they have. And, you know, Fannie Mae is going to go bankrupt, and Freddie Mac, unless the Federal Reserve creates a substantial amount of inflation to prop up the housing market. And so,
now I'm going to add right in here that they did go bankrupt. Okay, they did go bankrupt exactly the way he said it was, because the government would not allow the inflation to happen. The inflation didn't happen, and so the mortgage-backed securities that Freddie Mac had as security to back up their debt became less worth less than what the debt was, and that's why they went bankrupt. That exactly happened. So let's continue with Peter Schiff.
So the only way that these companies won't go bankrupt is if they create so much inflation, gold's probably going to be at $5,000 an ounce.
But if the dollar does make a comeback, if the world considers its current moves and its future moves to be serious about stopping inflation, to not lower the interest rates anymore, will gold continue to go up?
The dollar's not going to make a comeback. I don't care how much they talk it up. It's going to continue to sink.
That's not what I asked. If it does, if the dollar does hold its value.
It's impossible for that to happen. You know, you might as well ask me, you know, if pigs sprout wings, can they fly? The dollar's not going to go up.
Paul Volcker did stop inflation back in the 80s.
Right.
It's possible to do it.
No.
If Bernanke does it, will gold continue to go up?
No, he can't. What did Volcker do? He put interest rates at 20%.
Rates up to 20%.
Right. Is Ben Bernanke going to put interest rates at 20%?
So far he hasn't.
Yeah.
So far he has.
And if he did, would our economy completely collapse if we had 20%
interest back in the 80s?
Well, because we didn't have a $10 trillion national debt financed with T-bills.
We had a lot of debt compared to the GNP.
No.
It was still substantial.
Back in 1980, the national debt was, majority of it was 30-year government bonds, and it was owned by other Americans. Now the debt is majority T-bills, two-year T-bills, owned by the Saudis and the Chinese and the Japanese. It is a huge difference. There were no adjustable rate mortgages. Basically, the Fed no longer has the tools to defend the dollar. All it can do is debase it.
Watch this, David. Watch this. Peter, should we go back to the gold standard?
Well, Corey, you know the answer to that question.
His head's exploding.
No, well, we wouldn't have had a NASDAQ bubble.
Wipe your mouth.
Yeah, we wouldn't have had a NASDAQ bubble. We wouldn't now be on the verge of an unprecedented collapse in the American standard of living because of years of monetary excess. I would have much rather had a gold standard than Alan Greenspan and now Ben Bernanke.
Actually, it is true. If we had linked the dollar to gold back in the days when you first bought in a big way in 1999, what would oil be now?
10-year chart here.
Oil be now?
Well, you go back even further. We separated from gold in 1971. If we were still on a gold standard, oil would be about $3.50 a barrel.
Wow.
You know, all the difference is inflation. And, you know, when
the
government
would be making about $500 a year,
but we'd have a higher standard of living. I don't know what we would be making. But, yeah, we wouldn't have as high a salary. But the purchasing power, that's what's important. And, you know, when the government now they look at oil prices at $120 a barrel, they look what's happening with food prices. And they say, well, this is because of global economic growth. It's because of China. It's because of OPEC. It's not. All of it is because of the Fed. It's all because they're printing money. And that's why you got to own gold.
Okay, so can we broaden this discussion to other metals like silver and mm-hmm. platinum, and then maybe the non-precious ones.
Silver has always been a monetary metal, and I think, you know, gold and silver kind of go hand in hand. I think that there's a bigger move coming in silver. If gold is at $5,000 an ounce, you know, silver could be at $500 an ounce, and the ratio might be 10 to 1. Now it's, you know, 40, 50
By
to
the
one.
Way, when do you think gold will be $5,000 an ounce? How long from
now? I mean, I don't know exactly when. I don't have a crystal ball to know the exact date.
Ballpark figure.
I don't know. Probably before the end of maybe the next presidential term. So for 5 years from now, it could be up there. I think it could be, you know, it could be $2,000 an ounce sometime next year.
All right,
Peter, we'll save the tape.
We will. Save them all. I save them myself.
All right. So there you have it. So now what we're talking about here is of course, can't click your gold heels together to go back to the gold standard, but you saw what happened. When you took the value out of the paper, out of the ones and zeros, the only way that the government can actually try to stay ahead of the game is to continue to print money, to continue to create ones and zeros, because otherwise the alchemical formula doesn't work. So what happens is the dollar becomes ineffectual in the world market. And then what you will see, and what we have already seen, are news articles from other leaders of the G20, other countries, like especially China, who are saying, you know what, it's about time we had another global standard. We don't think the dollar should be the standard anymore. We need to have another standard currency. Let's try the yuan for standard currency. Well, you can't use the yuan because it's artificially set by the government. It's not allowed to float to market value. If it were allowed to float to market value, then China could not export at the rate that it's exporting because its goods would cost a lot more and they would be more competitive. But because China keeps the value of their yuan artificially low, not letting it float to the market value, then the exchange is artificially pumped up. And that being said, we're guilty too. We subsidize oil. We subsidize all kinds of industries in our country to make it unfair as well. Now, what effect does money printing have upon our business? Why not? I mean, if you own the presses, why don't you just print more money and just, you know, go buy what you want to buy? Well, that's what they've been doing. And believe me, it has its effect. Now, we have some experts on this, and we're going to talk about this right now. We call it the dollar bubble. This is where the alchemical formula begins to break down. This is where the Nephilim actually want this entire global system to go. Why do they want to do this? Because the idea is to get from a dozen different major currencies playing the game out there, where these people are floating literally trillions of dollars back and forth infinitesimally, buying chunks and bales and boatloads of cash of various denominations, nationalities, making this money actually adding no value to any system whatsoever. Nothing. They're not buying anything. They're not investing in anything. The only thing they're doing is making money off of the floating of the value between the monies. Okay? You might think it's wonderful if you've got the money out there. But what they're doing is they're ruining the rest of the world. They're getting not wealthy. They're going way beyond wealthy. They're becoming so wealthy that they can buy nations. Yes. They don't just buy cars. They don't just buy malls. They buy countries with this much money. And this is exactly what the Nephilim had in mind. Now, what I'm going to play for you now is a piece called the Dollar Bubble. This is the bubble that we're on with the American dollar. Are we going to go to the Amero? I don't know. It's been minted. It's been thought about. It's a combination of the Canadian dollar, the U.S. dollar, and the Mexican peso. It'll be awesome for Mexico. And they need something like this to stabilize that country. And maybe we need it too, because we have so many of them working here. It would be nice if they went home and earned money in their own country and make jobs for us. And maybe that's possible. Because I can tell you right now, of the 21.5 million illegals that are in this country, or national Mexicans that are in this country, I would say 90% of them would prefer to live in Mexico with their families. They're very family oriented. If they could make the money down there, they would go. Okay, here we go. The dollar bubble. Listen to this.
Will be like wallpaper.
We are on the precipice of a major economic financial collapse. I mean, what we've just experienced, I mean, that's the opening act. I mean, the real collapse is coming.
One stimulus package will lead to the next one and to more money printing. And so in 5 to 10 years' time, the real crisis will break out when the whole system collapses. That will be the end.
Eventually, this dollar is going to quit working, and then everybody's going to know what poverty is all about.
Our politicians need to understand why.
why the country is in this shape. It's because of them. It's because of the Federal Reserve and their policies, their regulations that have distorted the free market and that have created this mess. And that if they don't stop doing what they're doing, there's going to be no turning back.
As the fiscal deficit goes up, the interest payments on the government's debt also go up. They are now around $400 billion annually. I would think that they'll be around $1 trillion in 5 to 7 years' time.
Can you talk to us about the deficit? Are you worried? Should this be a near-term
priority?
Everybody
ought to be worried about the deficit. It's a big deficit, but the time will come to deal with it.
And so then the government goes bust, but before it does that, it will inflate its way out, or try to inflate its way out. And that won't work. So the next step will be to go to war. The whole thing will collapse.
So you see where it seems to be going. It's going exactly where the Nephilim wanted to go.
Hyperinflation nation 5 months ago, gold prices have increased from $925 per ounce to over $1,150 per ounce, while silver has increased from $14 per ounce to over $18 per ounce. The rise in the price of gold and silver is a result of the major monetary inflation being created by the Federal Reserve, which has held interest rates at 0% for almost a full year. Under the false pretenses of trying to get our phony economy to recover, the Federal Reserve is giving trillions of dollars away for free to bankers on Wall Street at the expense of the American middle class, who will soon see the purchasing power of their savings disappear. The false strength of our phony economy has become...
Well, what you see here is exactly the formula that we have been outlaying and that we laid out, especially in the second volume of The Ark of Millions of Years. This is exactly what the Nephilim designed into the plan. The plan was to make money, to make cash, to make a single denomination so unstable that it begins to become absorbed by other denominations, denominations that actually have value in them. Ron Paul made the statement recently that he would like to go to Fort Knox and physically have the doors opened, and he wants to see the gold. He wants to go into Fort Knox, have the doors open, and he wants to see the gold for himself. And I think the American people should go along with him with a live camera right over his shoulder. Because if that gold isn't there, if that value isn't sitting in Fort Knox, it's somewhere. And I doubt very seriously it's in a vault in Colorado. I don't think it's at NORAD. I don't think it's in one of the underground bases. I think the government gave it away. I think the government traded it. And I think that the Chinese may have it. The Chinese may have the gold, and that is what's backing up the money. That's why they keep loaning us the money, because we keep giving them the collateral. Now, that's my personal opinion, but I vote for Ron Paul. Let's go to Fort Knox and let's open the doors and let's see for ourselves what is there. If that gold is gone, then he's exactly right. That's exactly what happened. So... I'm a little miffed about this, but as I paint this picture for you, this how the Nephilim are going to do this, when the dollar collapses and it's absorbed by the Amero or some other global currency, we're going to drop down to two or perhaps three or four major currencies in the world. That's it. That's all there will be. And at that point, it makes it very easy to consolidate them into one global currency. Now, who's this going to hurt? Well, you might say, gee, that's a really good idea, you know, one global currency, and then, you know, we know exactly what we're trading to the Chinese, and they know what they're trading to the Russians and the Israelis and everything, and we'll all get along, and it'll be wonderful. It ain't going to happen. And the reason it's not going to happen is because those people that are trading the cash are the exact same people that are running our government. It's exactly right. The people that are running our government, not the elected officials, the ones that are running our government are the ones that are trading the cash. And there are some wannabes, there are some small people, and let me tell you, if you can borrow money at 0% interest, and we just heard that you could, and we have showed you on this program many times, $3.3 trillion in the last 10 years alone have been siphoned out of our country and dumped into this cash market. Trading currency, they will never let it happen. War will happen before that happens. And that plays exactly along the lines of the Nephilim. That's where we go. So this is a mystery of the earth. It is not a conspiracy theory, because I'm not blaming any individual person or organization, but I'm telling you, that's where it's going. And it's a design of the Nephilim, and it's ancient. Let's take a quick break, and we'll start hour three of X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We'll be right back. Back to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. If you want to be part of the program, and I would be overjoyed if you did, anywhere in the world live, 530-413-4511. 530-413-4515. As we enter into 2011, we have just a skunch over 11 months before we enter into the fateful year of 2012. I want you to do some planning. I want you to do some thinking. As we give you this content on this program and we introduce you to experts from all around the world that have written books and performed lectures and try to bring this expert knowledge to you, I want you to use that knowledge to empower yourself as an individual so that you can take control of your own existence, your own bounty, your own success. Be 100% responsible for your own life condition. Many of us don't have jobs. We are relying upon others for our well-being. We may feel as though we have abdicated our responsibility, our duty, our ability to run our own lives, to care for our own people. I want you to let that thought go, because this is the year that you're going to take control of that. Whether you work for a wage that you receive every Friday afternoon and a check from the boss, or whether you are on some kind of pension, or whether you work contracts, I want you to realize one thing right this minute. You are self-employed. You work for yourself. When you walk into that plant, don't worry about what you exchange for that dollar. You worry about what you exchange for you. Do your best and deliver it with everything you have, and you will be successful. Now, I want you to pay special care as you realize where you're spending your money, realize how you make your money. As an individual, you might feel powerless as these trillions of dollars are levering one thing one way and one thing another way, and you're hearing all this doom and gloom on the news, and you're tuning into X Squared Radio, and Brooks is telling you about these great forces that have been at work on the earth for thousands of years, and now they finally have the conditions just right where they can take control of everything. And they can dominate us and subjugate us. Well, there's a monkey wrench in the works. It's called human consciousness. And although the argument can be made that we have been communicating and yet are communicating with each other telepathically, we are also communicating with each other another way. We're communicating with each other through this global neuro network called the Internet. I'm doing it right now as I speak to you on Global Talk Radio. On the BBS Radio Network, the largest, most listened to Internet radio network in the world, and X Squared Radio, one of the top programs on that network, we are reaching far and wide. Many, many people are hearing these words tonight. And they're not words that the Nephilim want you to hear. They're not words that those that want you to settle down and behave yourself, become part of the floorboard, will you please, a nail sticking up is hammered down. We don't want you to think for yourself. We don't want you to imagine. We don't want you to remember who you are. I do. I want you to remember who you are. I want you to remember that you are this leaping, flying, amazing being with consciousness, absolutely unlimited, unlimited potential. And through commercials and training and rationalization dealt to you from the time that you could understand the difference between, quote, right and wrong, you have been beaten into what you are today. I want you to spread your wings and realize what a glorious being you are and how perfect you are, exactly the way you are. Oh, well, yeah, you'd like to have a little more hair. I'd like to have a little less weight. Come on, yes, but we are perfect who we are. We are exactly the Don, the Brooks, the Susan, the Mary, the Jim, the John that we are. And knowing that, you cannot be imprisoned. You cannot be ruled over. You cannot be subjugated. You know, I had an interesting idea. You saw the movie Social Network, and you think about Mark Zuckerberg and his immense wealth at such a young age and his brilliance at being able to code and craft this website that allows us to communicate with one another. And we're sending all kinds of stuff. Oh, it's personal stuff, it's pictures, it's notes, it's blah, blah, blah. But you know what else we're doing? We're marketing to one another. We're trading with one another. We're advertising to one another. We're sending information around the world in a flash to tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people in a matter of moments. Whether you've got 500 Facebook friends or 15,000 Facebook friends on three different Facebook accounts, you can reach a lot of people, more people than you ever could before, more than the rumor mill could even touch. And wouldn't it be amazing, wouldn't it be phenomenal to imagine that in one of these beer-inspired brainstorming sessions that Zuckerberg had with his hackers in the house in California, that they came up with the idea, what if we create a social network that cannot be stopped? What if we create something that is so amoebic with its so decentralized servers everywhere that if somebody really wanted to get a message out, they could do it and nobody nobody could stop them. We could tell each other something. We could use the social network as the real network news, the real way of getting the truth back and forth to one another, the real viewpoint, the underground viewpoint. What if it could be used for that? And guess what, my friends? It is being used for that. Have you opened up your message files lately? Have you looked at them? Do you see all the advertisements and the news articles and the op-ed pieces and the amazing blogs and stuff like that that are floating around in there? Of course you have. And as long as that happens, we cannot be subjugated. As long as we are able to speak to one another, as long as we're able to tap on the prison walls some coded message and get it from cell to cell around the world, we cannot be subjugated, and we will be free. We will always be free. We always were free. And we made the comment last week that, yes, we know all these underground bases are being built, and this, they've been built with our money, and how incredibly amazing the engineering is at the thousands of feet under the ground. They have these cavernous cities that literally they could move thousands, hundreds of thousands of people into. I don't suppose you got your card yet, did you? I didn't get one either. I must not be of the genetic makeup to make it to the cavern to help the human race carry on after the surface is wiped clean by whatever is going to strike it, be it war or biological weapons or aliens eating the brains of humans like we're seeing in sci-fi movies. But one thing's for sure, those people that are in power, those people that are spending the money, those people that are spending the money on something under the ground instead of more spread for them above the ground, they know something. They suspect something. Or they wouldn't be spending their money on it. They wouldn't be spending our money on it. They wouldn't be writing checks they cannot cash. As I said last week, there are only two reasons why someone would write checks they cannot cash that will not clear the bank. Number one, they don't expect them to clear the bank, and they don't care. And the other is, they're expecting a windfall. I doubt very seriously the second is true. I think they're writing checks like there's no tomorrow because there is no tomorrow to them. I think, and I think you agree with me, it's about time they packed up their stuff and they headed for the shelter. Let's get them locked in there. Let's let them put on their DVDs and play their world, their historical records over and over again, and have a good time. Grow old in the safety of the belly of the earth. We'll take it from here. What do you say, people? Come on, we're the people that know how to do stuff. We can do it. What do you say? Give me a call. And we'll talk about it. 530-413-4511. 530-413-4515. Don't you think it's about time that the leaders that have been spending our money building all this stuff in the ground, that they just go ahead and get in it? Might as well get while the getting's good, what I say. Let's let them get in it and take care of business, and we'll take it from here. So the Nephilim have unfolded their plan with perfection. 200 strong, maybe less. They can't be killed, but they can't be exiled, or they can't be left off-planet. That could be happening unless Aaron Kaplan is right, and they're imprisoned here, and they can't leave here. What if Nibiru is returning, and the Anunnaki are coming back to check on their genetic experiment that they left here? some 25,000 years ago. Maybe they're coming back to check on us. Do you think they'll realize that the cream of the crop, the best of the best, has crawled into these massive underground shelters all over the world? Do you think they'll realize that the ones that are left on the surface really aren't worth keeping, that the best, the sharpest, the smartest are really being saved under the ground? I don't believe that for a second. And you rarely hear me say that on this program, that I don't believe that. I will say I don't believe anything. I have beliefs, but I'm not going to share them with you. But I want data. If I can't measure it, if I can't put it between the jaws of a micrometer or put it on a scale or listen to it on a microphone or pick it up with a scintillation counter or measure its light or energy, I'm sorry. It doesn't exist. I want proof. I want evidence. I want some kind of real reality that it is there. And I think you are that way too. If you can't feel it, if you can't see it, if you can't taste it, if you don't know it in your gut, then it isn't real. It isn't part of your reality. And if it's not part of your reality, it doesn't exist. It might exist for someone else, but that's not you. Just because it makes them happy, gives them satisfaction, it gets them through the day, it calms their nerves, it doesn't do anything for you. I mean, if you're depressed, if someone comes up and says, hey, I'm happy, you should be too, does that work? I didn't think so. By the way, just parenthetically here, doesn't have anything to do with the program. Depression, it's a journey, folks. Some of us go on it. It's not a location. It's a journey. You'll make it through it. And when you do, you'll be tougher for it. And I don't think it's the right thing to do to inebriate yourself or to drug yourself out of that depression. Just go through it and come out on the other side. You'll be stronger for it. And I have heard people talk about chemical imbalances. I have a degree in biology. I also have a degree in chemistry. I'm not a biochemist. I'm not a doctor. But I think the term chemical imbalance doesn't make any sense, because there's no chemical balance. We generate our own hormones in all kinds of different directions. Can we control it? Not always. I mean, we go through menopause, we have depression, we have all kinds of things that happen because of it. But it isn't really a chemical balance, and who knows what the balance point is anyway. So if we are a Prozac nation, well, then I guess we're a Prozac nation. But it doesn't mean that you're chemically imbalanced. You're somehow imperfect. If you feel like you need some chemical help, better living through chemicals, I always say, if you need some chemical help, get it and get off. You can make it. And if you can't, you can't. I've had people ask me a lot of times, why do you think diabetes has continued to spread? Why do you think asthma is continuing to grow? Why is it? Well, I got news for you, folks. Those two diseases are genetically inherited. And in ages past, diabetics died. Asthmatics passed away, real bad ones. They didn't procreate. Those genes were, through natural selection, limited in their ability to procreate. But now we've learned how to artificially provide insulin. We've learned how to artificially dilate the bronchial tubes where an asthmatic can breathe normally. And so they grow old and they live normal lives way on up into their, grand years. They are able to procreate and they are able to be productive members of society, earning money and holding their own and living basically normal lives with the exception of their chronic medication. Well, that's why it's continuing to grow, because diabetics who have children will have diabetic children, and their children and so on and so forth, and it will continue to grow. What we need to do is learn what they did with rats. Yes, they induced diabetes in the rats, which were perfectly healthy to begin with, and then they had pups that had diabetes, even though it wasn't congenital. What we need to do is do the exact opposite. We have the ability to cure most kinds of diabetes. We're getting there with the others, with gene therapy, with robots, nanobots. There are ways of making the pancreas do what it's supposed to do. So once we cure a person of diabetes, they will have pups that are cured of diabetes, and that's how we do it. If Libby and Pfizer will let it happen. And if you have comments on that, I would appreciate it too. We've got about 30 minutes left on the program, and we've covered some interesting materials tonight. We started out talking about Nibiru and UFOs and the idea that since the latter part of October, we have had no reports. We've had no sightings. Do your searches yourself. Go on Google. Go on Yahoo. Go on Ask. Go on Bing. Look it up. Look it up for yourself. There's no fresh UFO sightings. There's no film. There's no big sightings, no big testimonies. There's no crop circles. Nothing. Nothing. And it's not just because it's winter time. Because last winter, it was crackling like every 30 minutes there was a UFO sighting. All the way, the whole year was amazing. 2010 was like the year of the UFO. They were everywhere, even over New York City. They were over El Paso. They were over Russia. They were over China. They shut down Beijing Airport twice. They were everywhere. This year, right now, the last 2-3 months, they're gone. And we talked about Nibiru, and is it possible for it to sneak up on Earth? Is it possible that Nibiru is approaching Earth and astronomers cannot see it? Yes, it is possible. Absolutely. Up until just a couple of years ago, before we launched the Kepler mission, we'd only identified probably less than 20 planets through perturbation theory, because it takes so darn long looking at a star and measuring its wobble and its vibrations and occasionally seeing a planet drift across the face of that star, thus diminishing the amount of light that it puts out, which is one way of measuring the size and the orbit of those planets. And then the Kepler mission has picked up on barely a couple hundred. Why? Because they're looking at stars, and they're looking for the planets and the wobble, and the same thing they were doing from here, only they're doing it closer and without the distortion of the atmosphere in the way. But Nibiru isn't that way. Nibiru is not orbiting around another star. It's orbiting around our star. And until the light of our sun shines on it, we're not going to see it, because it doesn't generate its own light. It's dark in space. It, for all intents and purposes, is a free-floating planet. Free-floating planet. That means it's going through space without an apparent orbit, although it may have a very highly elliptical orbit around both our sun and Sirius, which are two binary stars in revolution around each other. Yeah. So what you have is the possibility that Nibiru could be blazing through space at 0.1, 0.2 light speed, which is pretty darn fast. You're getting on up there about 18 to 20,000 miles a second. You're heading this way at that speed. And at that speed, you'll show up about 3 weeks, 4 weeks before you actually arrive here. We're going to be able to see you. That's not a whole lot of notice. And, you know, the argument has been made, yeah, but there's the Donald Morrison last week said on the program, there's thousands of amateur astronomers out there looking for it, and they haven't found it because it's not there. It doesn't exist. 2013 is going to come. Enjoy yourself. Nothing to worry about. I could play the clip again. It's just absolutely nauseating to hear NASA's official statement that everything's going to be okay. Nothing's going to happen in 2012. It's just another farce that's put out on the internet. Like the internet is completely illegitimate source of information. I got news for you. The internet is the new Library of Alexandria. It is the source. It is the storage place for every bit of information out there. Some of it's junk, but some of it's very legitimate. And a lot of these papers and studies are very good, and they open your mind. No, they're not mainstream, not affiliated with your university or your organization. But you buffoons at NASA are ignoring, at least from our point of view, a lot of the facts that are laying out there in front of your eyes. We know you know something, because the government wouldn't be spending or wouldn't be allowing $3-5 trillion of our money to be siphoned off to build these secret bases all over the world to hide the elite of the world and let us take whatever it is that's going to come. They wouldn't be writing checks on our grandchildren's bank accounts and without any care in the world, except that they know that those checks will never be cashed, because they, in their hearts, believe that our grandchildren will never be around. We know that that's happening, and so we know NASA knows something, but officially they're saying there's nothing. And I'm telling you that if you're sitting out there with a Schmidt Cassegrain 12-inch, by the way, that's a really nice telescope. Holy cow. If you got a chance to buy one, you should buy one just to have it, even if you never looked through it. That's a cool telescope. Anyway, long story short, they have motor drives. They have computer drives. You can set them up on a nice, stable pad in your backyard where temperature equilibrates and doesn't have the vibration of, you know, cars going by and the air conditioning in your house and kids running up and down the stairs to vibrate it. And you can turn it on at the same time every night, look at the same star every night, and you can take a 4 or 5 minute exposure photograph that you can download to your computer. And you can do that night after night after night. And at the end of a year, you can run a 365-frame movie, and you can see the bodies moving around space. And you'll see the stuff that doesn't move. It may move infinitesimally, but this is how comets are found by amateurs. This is how free-floating planets will be found. And I can tell you, of the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of private telescopes there are out there, I'll bet not a tenth of 1% does what I just said. They don't have internally cooled digital cameras mounted to their telescopes, which are connected to their computers, and they're not taking pictures every cloudless night and comparing one slide to the next slide to the next slide to the next slide to see what moved. Some are, but very, very few. The ones that are the ones that have comets named after them, because that's what they do. They name the comet after the person that discovered it. And most of the comets have been discovered from the Hawaii Observatory. But some of them, a good number of them, have been named after amateur astronomers that have first raised the alarm bell that we have a comet on the way. And they found it with a telescope just like the one I'm describing to you. Sometimes they use a regular refracting telescope, but not very often, because the field of view is less, because they gather less light. They can magnify more, and they're wonderful for looking at planets. But they're not so good for looking deep in space, because deep space puts out so little light. You need a bigger surface area, and you're going to get that through a mirror. And a Schmidt-Cassegrain, what it does, instead of having a 12-foot tube out there with a mirror at the bottom and an ocular eyepiece at the top, you fold that back and forth, and you still get a 12-foot look through a telescope that's 3 feet long. If you've got a Dobsonian scope, typically they have very large mirrors, 10, 12, 25 inches. I've seen some 25-inch mirrors out there at local observatories. But they're point and shoot. They're point and look. You cannot line them up with the same place in space every night and take a 4 or 5 minute exposure. They don't have that kind of motor drive on them, most of them. But the Schmidt-Cassegrain, the fancier Orion or Meade scopes, these are the ones that are really, really taking the classy pictures. And and we'll be the ones that that come up with the clear shot that we're looking for. And I'm telling you right now, they're not looking. They're not looking for Nibiru. It isn't out there that way. And NASA, they only have a few observatories. Of course, they got Palomar, and they got one in Hawaii, and they got the one in the South Pole. But if it's a highly elliptical orbit, and it happens to be coming in from the north, from that side of the solar system, sorry, we don't have any observatories that can see it. There might be some up in Norway, but they're not looking for it. I'm telling you, they may suspect that it's coming. They may have some gravitational signature. There's no pictures. There's no proof. But it could be. It could be coming. And if the ancients are right, and remember they poo-pooed Halley until Halley's Comet came back. That was 1629, folks. He was a prominent scientist, but they weren't going to see Halley's Comet return in his lifetime. And when it did return, the astronomers of that day went back to him and said, well, you know what? He's the guy that predicted it. It came back. And that's how I got the credit. But if it didn't come back, well, he wouldn't have been credited with it. However, we do have the Maya who are saying it came. We have the Sumerians, which ostensibly in their clay tablets are saying it came. And when it comes back, we want you to pay attention. Don't name it after us. Don't call it the Sumerian planet, because it isn't. It's the world of the Anunnaki. Okay? That's what we're talking about. And it could very well be on the way. That's what I'm trying to tell you. And what inspired me to bring this up, by the way, I said earlier in the program, I had a dream. I woke up this morning and I was at some kind of outdoor party, and I looked up and I said, you know, it's a clear sky, and I asked somebody next to me, hey, where's the moon? And they said, well, it's right over there. And sure enough, right over there was the moon. Low in the sky, nice and beautiful. Everything was great. And then I looked over to the right and I said, well, if that's the moon, then what's that? And I looked over the other way toward the east, and there was a crescent moon sitting up there. So if that's the case, and there's another moon up there hiding in the shadow of the earth where the sun, you know, can't see it, then it could be hiding out there. It could be approaching us from that point of view, and it could be such that the sun's light will not shine on it until the very last minute. And that's what makes it interesting. So if you have any thoughts on this, I of course, would always appreciate your phone calls. Be happy to talk to you about it. We've got about 18 minutes in the program, 530-413-4511, 530-413-4515. And by the way, we really appreciate our listeners out there. There are several. I have gotten emails from you. We thank you so much for those. It lets us know that the program is getting out there and that the sound quality is very good. They're listening by cell phone, and that number is 712-432-0075, and then they use the access code 318-116-pound, and that gets them the program live. They can't contribute, they can't call back in, but they can listen, and that means they can walk away from their computer, and they can hear everything that's going on, but they can't call back in, can't contribute. And we really, really appreciate you being there that way, because it means a lot to us. It's nice to have, to know that people are out there listening on that level. And it's convenient for them because they can just pop their Bluetooth in the ear and listen that way. And we appreciate it. As we wrap this up, January is a long month with respect to Sundays. We've now got a fresh batch of books in from various experts around the world. I'll be digesting those this week, contacting the publicists and getting the authors of those books on the program. The holiday season's a difficult time to get authors to come on. They're traveling or they're taking time with their kids and their families around the world. And so you've had to listen to me this month. But I've also had a lot of mail that says, you know, we really like having the guests on, but we like it when you just talk. So that's what I've been doing the last three programs. We've had a few clips and things that we play, and that's important to bring on so that you can see that the evidence is well vetted. It is well thought out and well put together. As we have done for the last couple of years, I'm not advocating a run at all, but I am saying very quietly, very cautiously, very slowly, very prudently, you should be moving your cash into your hands. Now, there will come a time when the banks will say, okay, we need you to bring all your cash, and we need you to put it back in the bank, and if you don't do it within a certain amount of time, you're not going to get credit for it. Sooner or later, maybe not this year, but early next year, there may come that message. If you're holding on to cash in your house, it is going to be worth less, worth nothing, if you hold on to it after a certain date. All previously printed dollar bills are going to have to be turned back in for the new dollar bills. The banks will cover the distribution of that money. You will be given full credit for all your money. Don't worry about it. Not a dollar will be lost, but you must bring your money back in and put it in the bank. And mark my words, that day is coming. I really don't know what you're going to do at that time. Somehow you're going to have to exchange your dollars for something that's worth something. Food, gold, silver, platinum, the hard metal, not the piece of paper. Now, that being said, you heard Paul Schiff on earlier a couple times talking about how much gold he's selling. If you go to these gold sources that you hear about, you hear George Norrie talking about it. He does a lot of gold commercials on his program. You also hear other talk show hosts talk about buying gold, buying gold, buying gold, and they all have people that advertise with their programs that they endorse. Do they really own gold? Who knows? But they're endorsing it, and that's what they're selling. Be careful, because a lot of those places cannot deliver the solid gold. There's no gold for them to deliver to you. You're buying gold that you're never going to see. They're going to hold on to the bullion. You're going to get some kind of certificate. But if you ever ask them to actually send you the gold, it ain't going to happen. Make sure when you're buying gold that you're getting the gold. I recommend the Krugerrand. No, I don't sell them. I don't know who does, but you can get them. You can also buy the Swiss bars. They're called Suisse. S-U-I-S-S-E. They're 99.9% pure gold. Buy them in 1 ounce bars. 1 ounce bars. Don't buy a bar that weighs 30 pounds or 10 ounces or 20 ounces because you won't be able to sell it. Nobody will be able to buy it. Buy it in 1 ounce bars. That's what's nice about a Krugerrand. It's exactly the right size and it's pure gold. You can carry it with you. You can stick it in your socks or your shoes, and you can get it around. If you own gold and you don't have the gold, you don't have the gold. So if you think you own gold right now and you have certificates, you better trade it in and get the gold. Because if oil is going up to what they say it's going up to, and OPEC is saying $100 gold, get used to it. It's a real possibility that if these things are moving in this direction, oil's going up and gold's going up, and you own gold, you better get your hands on the gold. On the actual metal, people, not a piece of paper. The actual metal. But I'm not a prognosticator in the sense that I think everything's going to go the way that Schiff and these others say it's going to go. I don't think there's going to be $5,000 gold. I don't think that the dollar will devalue to that point. I think other things will happen. Other forces will step in to stabilize, even if it's a trade of currency or a different kind of currency. But gold doesn't change in value. It is the value. And if you can't get gold, get silver. It's a lot cheaper. But definitely get the solid metal, okay? And very slowly, very carefully, I would at least hold on to a good amount of your cash in cash. You may need to have your money in the bank because you got to pay a house payment, or you got to pay a car payment, or you need it for insurance or tuition or whatever. But there's no sense sitting there with thousands and thousands of dollars of cash in the bank. If you're going to do that, leave the necessary funds in the bank and leave the rest in a bag somewhere where you know where it is. And I'm not trying to take any liability upon myself, but there were over 1,500 bank closings in the United States last year. 150 of them were big banks. And how does a bank go broke? It makes bad loans. It makes bad investments. And the shareholders profit take. And if a bank is going broke, they're doing something wrong. A bank that doesn't meet the credit needs of its community is probably not going to go broke because it's not taking a risk with the community. It's not using first mortgages on homes or anything other than first mortgages on homes as collateral. It doesn't invest in business. I know there are people that spend their whole life around announcing how terrible things are going to be, and we're not doomsayers here. And there are others that spend their whole life, you know, saying buy gold because I sell it. And everything's going to go up, up, up. Gosh, I've heard of $500 silver for 30 years, and you can still buy silver for less than 20 bucks an ounce. I remember I can't remember their name now, some brothers tried to corner the silver market, and they ended up going bankrupt. I remember rumors that the electronics industry was going to require so much silver that we were going to see $100 silver before the end of the year. And who was saying it? People that were selling silver. Look, I'm a statistician, and I can tell you, when somebody issues a study, 4 out of 5 dentists, or the American Bread Council, or the American Beef Council, read who paid for the statistics. Read who's paying for the advertisement. Okay? Do you think when George Norrie gets up there and talks about gold, or when G. Gordon Liddy gets up there and talks about gold, that they really want you to have the gold? No, they're making money off the advertisement. They're getting paid to tell you that. They're testimonials because of who they are and who they reach. So use common sense here. Educate yourself on what is value and what is not, and don't fret about it. And if you own a home, you own a home. But if you bought a home and you owe the bank and you stop making your payments, you're not going to be able to keep your home. And that's all there is to it. If the bank is between you and freedom, well, there you go. I'm just telling you everything that you need to know. The banks are the lowest, most blood-sucking, leech-ridden industry in the world. They always have been. They always have been. Why do you think Jesus went into the temple twice and threw them out? Drove them out with whips because they were making money off of people's money when they were coming in trying to trade with the temple. They were trying to buy doves and different sacrifices that had to be done at the temple, and they weren't getting one for one. The money changers were profit-taking off of them, which is exactly what the banks do. They take money they don't even own, and they loan it to you, and they make interest off that money. You think they're making, you put the money in the bank and they pay you 2% interest. You borrow the money and they charge you 8% interest. You're thinking they're making 6% interest, right? That's not true. They're making more like 36% interest. And if I could have you in front of a chalkboard, I could show you how they do it. That's how banks make money. And don't you think it's a little bit strange that every few years a bank has to build a new $2 or $3 million branch? Where do you think they got the money? They got it from you. And why did they have to build a $2 or $3 million branch? Because if they didn't, they'd have to give the money to the shareholders, the people that actually own the bank. And the shareholders decided, let's build more real estate because the real estate will hold its value. Because if I take money out of the bank, guess what I got to do? I got to pay taxes on the extra income. And I don't want it. I want the bank to continue to grow in value so the stock that I own in the bank will continue to grow in value. And someday, when I'm ready, I'll sell the stock and I'll make money. That's why you see these $2, $3, $4, $10 million bank buildings everywhere. That's why it's the Bank of America Stadium in Charlotte, North Carolina. That's why it's the Verizon Stadium. That's why it's the Bank of America 600 or the Coca-Cola 500, because those companies have to do that. Or they have to pay taxes on the money. That's the way it works. Well, all I'm telling you is the banks add no value to your community. They don't add value to your money. The money is best served doing work for you, which means it should be in metal or it should be in your hands. And only what's in the bank is what's absolutely necessary to do your commerce. Don't save money in your checking account. It's nuts. You're making no interest off of it, and the bank is investing it. When that bank closes at 5 o'clock in the evening, that money is invested on the money market. And it comes right back when it's needed at 9 o'clock the next morning when the bank opens. Yeah, that's why banks want in the securities business. And they don't add value to your money. You add value to your money. So secure your investments wisely. Invest in things that you know and that you can touch and that you can feel and that you know about. And if anybody wants to call in and argue about this or talk about this, I'd be happy to do it. Let's talk to Daniel from Minnesota. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks, Brooks. How you doing?
Hey, I'm doing wonderful. Welcome.
Well, thank you. I just wanted to make a couple comments. I really appreciate your show, and you're right on the money. And when you talk about the survival, people better take this seriously because there isn't much time left. I'm very fortunate to be taught by one of the greatest teachers ever to walk this planet up in Washington State. And he's covered extensively what you're talking about there. And when you talk about Nibiru, this is something that's going to happen probably within the next year for sure. And it's my understanding that it'll knock out the electromagnetic field. It'll knock all the satellites, all the power out. So one better get prepared.
Well, it's for sure that all the satellites, the geosynchronous ones and the ones that are in fast orbit around our planet, are relying only upon the gravity of Earth to keep them in their precarious orbits. If another gravitational field comes into the influence of Earth, you can bet that those satellites are going to have a hard time staying in their location.
And it's my understanding also that when the Bureau enters this field, it'll cause these solar flares, and the solar flares is what's going to cause havoc. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of catastrophe on account of that. And so what you talked about is right on, and I hope people take it seriously. One thing I have to correct you on: you said silver you can buy for less than $20 an ounce. It's $28.50 to close that Friday. It was up 83% last year. Gold is up 27.2%. So I just wanted to tell but I follow it religiously daily, and I understand what it's about there.
Well, there you go. See, that's how far behind I am. And really, $28, you think about it, that's not really a whole lot of money. But, you know, platinum's a lot more expensive than that. Rhodium's $50 a gram, $50 a gram. That's like $1,600 an ounce. So these precious metals, if you want to put your money in them, you're never going to lose your money because the value of the money, the value of the metal will always buy the same amount.
Well, that's exactly right. And, if you buy gold or silver, they say you should buy it for basically an insurance purpose because it'll always keep going up. If it costs $100,000 for a loaf of bread, at least your gold will buy you that. But you got $100,000 in the bank, you know, that's only going to buy you one loaf of bread. But the gold will go up in value to compensate for the hyperinflation, which is probably going to be coming into very soon.
Well, I guess my comment was that the gold never actually changes in value. The gold will buy the same amount today that it bought 1,000 years ago, but it's going to definitely change how many dollars it takes to buy that ounce of gold.
Exactly. And it's a lot better place to put your money than putting in the bank, that's for sure. And what you're talking about the banks is right on. The only place you have money is in a community bank. Any of those big banks, those guys are part of the guys you're talking about. And a person shouldn't even deal with those people. But
yes, I couldn't agree more. I have two criteria when I talk about putting money in banks. And you're right about the community banks because that money pretty much stays local. It doesn't get siphoned off to New York or Chicago or, you know, one of the big banking centers like Boston. And the other thing is that the local banks, you can actually become part of the board of that bank if you're a sizable depositor. And you can influence that bank by visiting it, which, you know, at least they know your name. If you walk into Bank of America somewhere, I bet you they have to look up your account every time you go in.
Well, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. However, the big banking system there, I can see where they're making an attempt to try to get rid of these smaller banks. They're making them come with their insurance deposits 2-3 years in advance because, of course, the FDIC is broke. And, it's just interesting the way everything's unfolding, and unfortunately, it's not going in a positive direction. But
the good news is, Daniel, that we're informed, and when we're informed, we're empowered. As long as we don't sit around and waste this year, 2011, and not get prepared, we have the knowledge now in January. Sit down with your family and make some goals for this year, make some real dollar goals. Put an A list, a B list, and a C list down and say, you know, at the end of the month, if we have disposable money, we're going to start picking up what's on the A list. I'm saying, you know, put gold or something of value, food, storage, on the A list.
Well, that's exactly right. It's like that one economist said, invest in anything Ben Bernanke can't destroy. So basically, you put it in food or anything that comes out the ground, he can't destroy that. But all a person has to do is see what's going on with the food prices. You know, they're escalating in price with the weather the way it is around the world. There's been riots in Tunisia, Greece, a lot of these countries over food. So food's going to be a very serious matter in the not too distant future. And you know, that's the number one thing one should look at is basically having a real food, I guess, supplier, well, gardens.
You're exactly right about that.
Yeah.
You're up there in wheat country. In Russia, they lost an entire crop this last summer. You know, the country burnt down. If you didn't pay attention to the news, they had record
heat exactly
all
right,
summer.
Yeah. Well, that's right, and also in Pakistan and in China, they had crop failures, and now Of course, what happened in Australia, they lost about $1 billion worth of wheat there. So, you know, things are going to get tight here pretty quick.
Yeah, exactly. And I just wanted to reiterate, people, when I say, you know, metal doesn't lose value, that's exactly what I mean. It's the dollars that lose value, not the metal.
Well, that's 100% accurate right there. And I just wanted to call in and say thanks for what you're presenting there. And I would say what you picked up on your dream is accurate. And this is going to come into manifestation whether we like it or not. And that's just the way it is.
Well, I hope they don't come eating brains. That's all I'm saying. I hope they come in peace and they're impressed with what we've accomplished and maybe give us some guidance to help us become a little better race, a little less warlike and a little bit more of the explorers we were born to be and not like what the science fiction films are depicting them to be now.
Well, a person really shouldn't really believe in those old science fiction movies because most of those are backed by the people that want to put something on your mind, what they want you to believe, you know. And the bottom line is that the power is in each and every one of us. And Christ himself said, all things I have done, you can do in greater. So basically what we have to do is raise our basic consciousness and awareness and become empowered and, you know, bring it on.
All right. Well, that was Daniel from Minnesota, I think a first-time caller. And you know, people pay attention to this. And you know, it's I'm not talking about semantics here. We're not getting in a world of semantics. If you buy gold for $1,000 an ounce and you sell it for $800 an ounce, you're going to think in your mind, I lost $200. And you did. Why? Because you sold the gold for money. Money is the thing that lost the value. Now, if you wanted to buy the gold for $500 an ounce, and later you wanted to trade that gold for land, you'll be able to buy exactly the same amount of land with that gold, no matter what the price is. That's why I'm saying. Land doesn't change in value, and gold doesn't change in value. It's the dollar that changes in value. The dollar is not the measurement of value. It's how many ounces of gold per acre. That would be real value because those are two real commodities, dirt and gold. Two real hold-in-your-hand commodities. Dollars are not a commodity. Dollars are worthless. It is the alchemical trade of your value. And that's all the time we have this week. We will be back same time next week right here on X Squared Radio. Thank you so much for the calls, and we'll see you next week.
Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.